Accession number 10295, Rule 9.
Mr. Lane, Rule 9.
Yeah, well, as I say, the railway had already started at Bangkok. I'd come through as far as Bampong. And then, after we'd completed the hut building, we then had to go out with the rest of them building the railway. The job then was, you probably read about it, digging the earth and piling it up into a whacking great pile. I think our job at that time, I think we had to go to 3 metres. It's either 3 metres, 3.5 metres, something like that, high. And 5 metres in length for our group. And once we'd done that, then we were free to go. And this started around about Christmas 42. And just after Christmas 42, further other prisoners came up, and we got an influx of officers as well. And about this time, the officers were told that they were to work on the railway with us, which gave a little bit of credence to this film, you know, the Bridge on the River Kwai, because the officers refused. They'd been told to refuse, and they did. And on this particular day, they'd refused. It was a really hot day. The Japanese said, right, will you stand there? And I can visualise it even now. At the top end of Chiang Kai, there'd been a hill, and they'd been digging into it for some reason or other. But the material, you know, the soil, was red, like a tennis court, red, orangey colour. It was like that. And they got all these officers stood in a semicircle with this as a background and the machine gun on the back of a truck pointing at them. And everybody laughed. They said, you know, they wouldn't do it. Forget it. And we were taken out to work. That was around about 7:30 in the morning. And just brought lunch out to us in the afternoon, the usual rice and hot water. And then at tea time, about 5:30, when we were coming back, and the officers were still there. And for those who knew the officers, it might have meant something. But for us who didn't know them, we didn't recognise any of them as someone we knew, then it was of no consequence to us. We came away and we said, you know, that's your fate. It's you. You're standing there, not me. So, too bad. And we just forgot about it. And then I believe somewhere around about 9 o'clock at night, the Japanese commandant came round and said, right, go and join your men. And consequently, the next morning, the officers went out with us, but they were in charge. So we'd got our own squads doing the digging. You got either a sergeant major, an RSM, CQMS, somebody, warrant officer, in charge of you. And above him, you've got a lieutenant, or whatever. And above him, a private Japanese soldier, or Hancho, or Shoko, or whatever, over the top of them. And it was back to the routine then of delegating straight the way down the line. I worked on the railway at Chiang Kai as far as the quarry, which was, I think it would be about 1.5 to 2 miles away. And then, for some reason or other, being a bugler, I had to sound last post on this, that and the other, most of the funerals. I used to go out over the wire with the lads, plugging gear. But because of this, I got a job in the hospital cookhouse, which kept me off the railway. And in a way, I think that's what saved my life, more or less, more than anything. In that I got extra food being in the cookhouse. You always look after number one. It kept me fit. And I didn't have anybody browbeating me and knocking me about. Consequently, I teamed up with several of the lads that was there that were... Everybody said they were rum buggers, I suppose they were, but they were regular soldiers like me. There was myself, MacDonnell, Ozzy Chamberlain. Oh, forgotten the name now. Jackie Rotherham. And we formed a team. What we did was, there's no wire, there's no bamboo around the camp, anything like that. you just got the cemetery at one end, and that cemetery is sacrosanct. You can't go and use it for anything other than burying people in. So we used to go down to the either to the village at Chunkai, or down to the fishing village at the approach to Chunkai, or on to Mampong. And if you had blankets, anybody had brought a ring with them, wedding ring or signet ring, anything like that, a swan pen, seal it, a lighter, watch, anything like that, we would take the risk of going down to the village with these articles, flog it, work out a situation where we got 15% of the value of the article. The rest was given to the owner. We kept 15% for our troubles. At the early stages, that was ours. But later on, out of the 15% that we earned, we deducted 2%, and that was given to the hospital. Now, we'd done it with success. But the officers found out about it, and they decided they would do the same. Well, whether it was through them doing this or whether it's pure accident, I don't know. But we had a dog. I've always had a dog. And this was McDonnell's. It was similar to an Alsatian, but not quite as big. He hated Japs. But to anybody else, you could push him to what you want.
You could tell the difference.
Oh, yeah. You can smell a Jap a mile off. And as soon as he smelled one, he'd bark. It was good for us because it signalled there was a Jap in the area, so we'd go to ground. So we took him out one day with us, and everything went well. We got all gear and everything. And as we got back, Butch, we used to call him, Butch started barking and running. So as he was running one way, me and Mac decided to run the other. Mac went to the river, and along the riverbank. I run for the cemetery. And as I got into the cemetery, I knew it was my mistake, because it was wide open. And it, as I said, the cemetery's sacrosanct, you shouldn't do it. But I did. I mean, it's life and death. And as I run through, the Jap was waiting for me there. And wait, you know. So I froze, and I got two bags with me. One had bananas, tomatoes, different fruits, papaya, and stuff like this in it. And the other one had Thai tobacco. And round my neck, I'd got two English water bottles with Thai whiskey that we'd bought. Well, the Japanese are not noted for having courts martial or commanding officers' court or anything like that. They can mete out the punishment there and then. And this punishment was that I would stand there in the middle of the cemetery, and this was 9 o'clock at night, and I would eat all the food myself, and I would drink all the whiskey that was in the bottles. And that would cure me. You know, I'd be sick as a dog. I'd probably die anyway with the alcohol content. But that was his punishment. And I had to stand there. And I was reluctant to do it, because we paid good money for this, you know. So I took our banana and started eating that. And speedo, you know, eat it. And I ate one or two bits. And then he went to the top end of the cemetery to have a smoke. And while he was up there having a smoke, a voice came out of the dunes. What are you in for? What's he doing that for? So I gave him my name, whoever it was, told him who it was. I said, I've been caught coming over the wire with food and drink. So he said, do you need any help? I thought, oh, you know, it's going to be wasted anyway. I said, any way you want. So then, I would say there'd be about four or five of them slid in. And they took bananas out and, you know, stuff like this. And a bottle of whiskey, took it away. And then came back and slung the empty dunes back at me. Empty water bottle. And when the Jap came, all I'd got in the morning, all I'd got left was the tobacco and some banana skins. He knew what happened, you know, Kura, Nanda, and all this that business.
Kura what?
Nanda. What's going on? What's happened? So they gave me a couple of fourpenny ones, belted me a few times, and then he marched me to the kennels. And I was in the kennels for 24 hours, and that was it. That was my punishment.
What were the kennels?
Those are, it's a kennel built from bamboo. There's six or seven in a line. And they're like dog kennels. The ground, dirt floor, bamboo all the way around outside. And they're about 4 foot high. You don't go through a door, there's a hole at the bottom. You crawl through this door. And then they put a doings there, a couple of bamboo sheaves, and you're locked in. And our sportsman, I was in, as I say, 24 hours. Some lads are within there for 10 days, 14 days. All they do is give you water and rice. Anything else you do there. If you want to piss, you do it in the corner. If you want to shit, you do it in the corner. You want to wash, then you use the water that you're using for drinking. There's no facilities whatsoever. He just stayed there and stunk for 10 days.
What was it like in there?
Bloody awful. I was there for, as I say, 24 hours. They show you Alec Guinness in a metal one, but I never saw a metal one. They were all open, definitely open, bamboo stuff. Anyway, they let me go. And then, I think it was a couple of weeks later, the Japanese had then inaugurated a system whereby our own people would police. The Japanese, they couldn't afford the men to patrol the grounds. So we had our own police force in the camp. And I don't think I should mention his name, but I will. The provost marshal was a fellow called Mark Quinn, Lieutenant Mark Quinn. I'll never forget the bastard. I don't know what unit he was in. Before the war, he was a reporter for the Daily Dispatch, I think it was. And he was the provost marshal. And under him, his sergeants. One, I won't mention his name because his sister and his family think he died a wonderful death. He was a sergeant in the Manchester Regiment, in my regiment. He was a boxer. A very jovial, very well-liked young fella. I thought the world of him, you know, as a lad. And like me, he'd been on boy service. And with him, there was a lad out of the Loyals, another sergeant. I think for the benefit of him, we'd call him Mick and Pat and Mick. But this particular day, we'd been out over the wire. And these new policemen had been inaugurated. And we came in, and naturally, Butch didn't bark. There was no Japanese. We'd been over the wire, done the job, come back, no problem. We're coming marching in with the stuff. And as I got through where we were breaking through the thicket, you know, the jungle type, you could see a well-worn path, you know. As I came through, gotcha. And there was these two sergeants. As I say, one was out of my regiment. And they grabbed me. Now the dog didn't bother. He was with Mac, actually. And they dragged me over to the, what they call the guard room. It was a hut built by the Thais. It was not bamboo, it was wood. Good solid thing. And I was marched into this. You had to go up a step and then through the door. And when I got inside, here is this Mark Quinn. He got himself a storm lamp. You know these things that you pump? Like a lantern thing.
Hurricane lamp.
Similar to that, like a gas mantle thing. Well, he had one of those. And it's pumped up, very bright. And behind it, he got a piece of metal, which was polished like a mirror, which gave more light. And then I was dragged and sat into this chair. And the stuff that I'd brought in with me was dumped on the floor. And they said, and this stupid bloody officer said, "Right, now talk." I thought, oh, where am I? In America? You know, is this a gangster or am I talking to an English officer or what? And he says, "Come on, talk. It'll be all the better for you." And he goes through all the bloody rigmarole, you know. And while he's saying it, this sergeant out of my regiment belted me behind the ear. You know, "You're a bastard." And then the other fella had to go. "Well, you can hit me as much as you like, but if you call me a bastard, I get upset." So I got upset and I started fighting back. And there was one hell of a schmozzle. I mean, I was coming off worse, I know that. But it was causing such a row that the Japanese quarters, which were just up the road a bit, they could hear it. And of course, two of them came running down. And as soon as they came running down, "What's going on, Mandananda?" Mark Quinn turned around and told him exactly what I'd been. I'd been over the wire and they'd caught me coming in. Wasn't they good? They'd captured me. So, of course, again, I got another bloody good hiding. And again, down into the kennels. I was in the kennels then for 5 days. And just on the fifth day, it was either 4 days or 5 days, there was a Japanese general coming round to examine, you know, we were being treated well and all this, that and the other. And as he came to the kennels, which was at the back of the hospital, as he came down, I don't know, I flaked out. I don't even remember him, to be quite honest. Didn't see him or anything, but I flaked out. And apparently he told him to carry me out, the Japanese, and put me in hospital. And as I say, there was 6 or 7 kennels, and he emptied all bar one. There was just one man left in. He told him to clear all the rest out to the hospitals. Otherwise, I'd have been in there and probably died in there.
Why just one left?
He'd done something wrong. I think he'd either attempted to escape or something stupid. But he died anyway. He died in there. But that was an English officer, an English conscripted officer, and a gentleman.
Why do you think that he and these two sergeants, what was their motivation?
Priority for themselves, to curry favour with the Japanese. What happened was that one of the sergeants, as I say, I don't want to release his name, I wouldn't like to upset his family. He, when we left that particular section, or them particular months, he left the police, other people took over, and he started running a coffee stall. By coffee stall, I mean, he used to get rice from somewhere, and if you burn it, rice, I mean literally burn it on a piece of tin, scrumble it up, pour boiling water on it, you've got coffee. And he run this and started making money. He got into one or two other things, same as I was in, rackets. And so much so that he'd acquired a fair smattering of money. Then he started going around, there was a hell of a shortage of water, especially when the cholera came. And this fella went round then, boiling water, creating water, you know, and selling it. And you could buy a pint of water for £5. So he was going around selling water at £5 a pint. Well, we couldn't afford it. But most of the officers could. And a lot of them carried checkbooks, still had checkbooks from before the war. And they paid for water with a cheque, and on the back of it they said they'd written, in the event of my death, this cheque must be honoured, and signed again with the name. And when I last saw him, each bloke that was a henchman like that, each bloke that was well off, he always had a leg man, a bloke who carried his money for him, and you know, so he'd never caught with any money.
What's a henchman?
A leg man. A henchman is a senior officer. But our lads, any lads who were, what can you call them, godfathers, you know, that type of thing. They had
commander.
A leg. Yeah, they had a, no, the top boy, he was the godfather, the bloke who planned it all, did it all. But he had what we call a leg man. And the leg man used to hold his money, or any documents, or jewellery, anything like that. The leg man had it. He was a simple, stupid man, who nobody would, you know, think would have the money. Well, I knew the leg man, and we were talking one day, and he was telling me he was carrying well over £400 in cheques, £400 English currency cheques, as well as, you know, hundreds of pounds in notes, in Thai notes. Unfortunately, the sergeant never got the value of the money, because he was on the Japanese transport that went down. He's one that died, and when I heard about it, I got a nice stiff drink and I said, good luck to you. I hope you rot in hell. I hope you're still crying. Because I couldn't stand him. You know, any man that can turn on his mate like that, I've no time for. And yet he was such a real decent lad beforehand. Good guy, you know. So that was that. Anyway, from there, was at Chung Kai. As I say, I was doing the cookhouse. I also got to the dizzy position of being promoted while a prisoner to corporal. Colonel Strauss, or Major Strauss, I'm not sure which he was, but he promoted me. And each time he was there, I put my stripes on. But each time I had to come into the camp, I had to take my stripes down and become a drummer again. I was a bugler. I sounded the last post. And then in the evenings, I'd have to go and set the fires at the crematorium. The lads would build them during the day, put the bodies on, and then somebody had to be delegated to set fire to the funeral pyres and see that they were properly burnt. So I had to do that. because I was a cook. I was in charge of fires. You know, so then from there, I go to the cookhouse and work all night. Well, semi-work type of thing. And then in the morning, I'd kip until 11. Then from 11 till 1 was funerals and dinner. And then in the afternoon, I'd have a couple of hours sleep. And then go to the creme again, set fire to the doings, to the bodies. So much so that I think more or less everybody knew me and I knew everybody else in Chiang Kai. And in the hospital cookhouse working for me, I had Tappy Hall out of the Norfolks. He was a one-time professional boxer. Georgie Wilson. He was a professional chef from Guernsey. Jimmy Walker, I think his name was. Tommy Walker from Yorkshire, a little 5'4" lad, who heart of bloody gold. And these were the lads that worked with me in the cookhouse. And in 1943, the Japanese had captured three men who'd tried to escape out of the... there was one out of the Fusiliers, Northumberland Fusiliers. I think one was RAOC. I forget what the other was. But they'd been caught trying to escape. Same as the lads down in Singapore, they'd been executed for trying to escape. But these three lads, they got them outside the Japanese guard room. And from the hospital cookhouse, you could just see them in the distance. And with me, I was big-headed, I was cocky. And I thought, everybody knew me. I might be able to have some influence with the Japanese. I didn't realise even then that this was beyond me. These blokes are going to be executed. There's no way a private soldier can do anything about that. So I went towards the guard room. And I couldn't get within 10 yards. It was Kura Bagheera and all this, that and the other.
Kura what?
Kura Bagheera.
Bagheera?
Bagheera. It's Japanese for Kura, bastard, bugger off, and all this all put together. Bagheera, Bhuggero. Bagheera. Kura, Khura. The Japanese, swear words, I would think. And anyway, these lads, what I was trying to ask the Jap was, could I bring them a drink? And above all the noise, the lads were shouting back to me, you're wasting your time, we don't need a drink, we're going to be dead tomorrow, stop worrying, you know, forget it, go back to where you were and all this, that and the other. So I went and spent a bloody awful night in the cookhouse, and then in the morning, we normally, being cooks, preferential treatment, we could wash, we had plenty of water to wash with, we couldn't get down to the river, same as the other lads, so I was allowed to wash with some of the water that had been brought up for cooking. So instead of having the wash as normal, what you had to do, if you had any spare time, was to go into the jungle, collect firewood, bamboo and stuff like that, and bring it in. So this particular morning, I had my breakfast, a quick breakfast. I wouldn't have any bath. I went in the jungle purposely to, you know, get some wood in as quickly as I could, get it back, and then be there in time to attend the, you know, sound the last post, these two, three lads. So I went in, to go into the jungle, you go out of the camp gates, up a little bit of an embankment, over the railway line, and then you're in the jungle proper. And it was jungle. And the bamboo, you just got hold of it, old bamboo, and just pulled it like that, and it fell down. It was rotting, dead, but it was good for burning. Well, if you could pick, say, four of them in a day, you've got enough fuel then for keeping your fires going all the time, you know. So it was habit that everybody brought fuel back in with them after they'd been out. And I went and, I picked three or four stems up, you know, pulled them down, tied them together with the rattan. And I was just going to come back again, you know, back to camp. And I could hear this slubbing coming through the jungle. More than
what?
Crumping, slumping, you know, in the jungle. More than one man. And I just hung back a bit. And then coming through the jungle was party of about 12, 15 Japanese. Behind them, there was the three lads still tied, you know, with their hands. And then behind them was Padre Duckworth. And there was two officers, two English officers, I don't know who they were. And then behind them was two Japanese officers and some other bits and pieces. Now, they marched these three lads into a clearing, and they was given a chunkle. A chunkle is a piece of wood, spade-like, you know, you just... They were given those and start to dig their own graves. They chunkle it out. And then at the top end of it, oh, they had a shovel as well, or a spade, one of the Japanese. And then they banged a bamboo pole in at the top of each. And the lads were told to go and stand at the pole, and then they put their hands behind them and tied them to the pole. And I was curious, and then I was sick. Because they just, without any ceremony at all, they just turned around the Jap and shouted something in Japanese. And there were six kneeled down, six above them, and they just on fire. And that was it, with, you know, these three dead bodies. I think it's the first time in my life, I don't think I've ever done it since, that I cried. I was really upset. You know, it really hit me what life was about. Life was about, you know, living, and death was death. Death was the end, you know. And I couldn't pace it. I was crying. And lay down where I was, crying like bloody mad. I must have been there for an hour. And they'd
who
all
are these three?
The names, I've got them in me in my book somewhere. I can send them you on if you want.
That's alright.
But there were three brave lads anyway. And then after I controlled myself, I got up. I had to take the wood back, otherwise I'd be in trouble. But I went over to where the lads had been buried. And they'd thrown the three pieces of bamboo, they'd thrown them in with them in the hole and covered it up. And there was a Siamese chap, two women and a kiddie. And they came. And they started putting proof on me. On the graves. And when they saw me, they said, go, 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 you know, Japanese. In other words, the Japs will come, and if they see us here, you know, there'll be trouble. So I had to go and leave them. So I didn't know which was which or anything like that. I know since the war, I gave them the, what they call it, the location. Since the war, I do know they've been recovered because they're in the cemetery at Chunkai. I'm saying I do know. They're in the book, and, you know, there's a grave there that they're supposed to be in. And then I reported back and told my CO about it, which was then Colonel Strauss. I was in honest strength in the cookhouse. And I was really mad. That was in March. And then in June, July the same year, as I said, I had the run of the doings. I had the run of it.
Right, let's...